In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Q Files have revealed some of Northern Ireland's hidden secrets.
What I came to see was that there were files that were being released. They were just being released in a place where almost nobody in Northern Ireland was looking for these files, and that's at the National Archives at Kew in southwest London.
In the last episode, we discussed declassified files on Martin McGuinness, the IRA, and on the SDLP.
This is the government trying to work out, do we basically cut our losses and say Sinn Féin are just going to be the dominant party of nationalism and therefore forget about the SDLP? A Troubles without the SDLP, he decides, is a deadly thing.
But intelligence wasn't just picked up on nationalists. The Northern Ireland office also kept their eyes on unionism and loyalism.
They imported a massive shipment of arms to Northern Ireland. There were three sections of that shipment. One went to the UDA, one went to the UVF, and one went to Ulster Resistance.
In this episode, we look into those files. Did the SAS really hire a mercenary to kill Peter Robinson?
There was an allegation made at the time by Peter Robinson that the UK government had hired a mercenary, a former SAS person, to murder him in the Irish Republic.
How did the UK government respond to the Ulster Resistance paramilitary group?
There are people who, I think, their sense of Ulster Resistance is that it was a bit of a joke. What you get from these files and what you get from some other documentation is a sense that this group was far more significant to the Troubles than people maybe realise.
And what terrorist activity did the British government suspect the now Deputy First Minister, Emma Little-Pengelly's father, Noel, of being involved in?
In 1989, he was arrested by French police in Paris with an American arms dealer. They were trying to sell missile technology from Shorts to the South African apartheid regime.
In this second part of a two-part special of The Bell Tell, our Northern Ireland editor, Sam McBride, joins me to discuss what he found when he opened the Q files. Intelligence wasn't just picked up on nationalists. The NIO also kept their eye on figures in unionism and loyalism. There are some interesting lines that you've picked up around Peter Robinson after his notorious so-called invasion of Clontibret in the Republic of Ireland, which many of our younger listeners may have no recollection of whatsoever.
Well, just to simplify this, on July the 7th, 1986, Peter Robinson was involved in a group of something like 200 loyalists who crossed the border into Monaghan, into the tiny little village of Clontibret, and they basically took over for, I think, a couple of hours. There were Garda who were sent then to the area. There were ultimately scuffles that broke out. There was graffiti daubed on some of the buildings. There was some damage done to some of the property of residents there. And it became a very controversial incident because Peter Robinson was involved in this. And more than that, he was arrested. He was the only person who was arrested at the scene.
The loyalists came from County Armagh in about 30 cars and arrived in Clontibret shortly after 1:30 this morning. Local people said there were up to 200, many of whom wore masks and carried sticks. The loyalists painted slogans on several buildings in Clontibret, including the Garda station. Two officers were kicked to the ground and beaten with sticks. Both were taken to hospital in Monaghan. Three detectives who had been in another car fired a number of shots into the air to disperse the crowd, who ran back to their vehicles and returned to the north.
He's then charged. He has to appear in court in the Irish Republic. Now, this is during the Troubles. It's a very, very different scenario to what pertains today. So the idea of crossing the border for somebody like Peter Robinson would have been unusual, I think it's fair to say, during the Troubles. Ian Paisley, Peter Robinson, I doubt very many times they crossed the border during the Troubles at all. And in these circumstances, these high-profile circumstances where there was a knowledge that he was going to be up in court on a certain day, the route was probably fairly obvious. There was a very significant risk to him personally in terms of his personal security. So there was an allegation made at the time by Peter Robinson that the UK government had hired a mercenary, a former SAS person, to murder him in the Irish Republic, essentially. It sounds extraordinary to say, but that is what he said. He was the DUP deputy leader at the time. He made this public. He said that he had received a document in the post by recorded delivery from somebody whose name was given. It wasn't sent to him anonymously. And he said that he was taking it very seriously. What we see in these files is that there are two files in particular which deal with the period after this so-called invasion of Clontibret. And what the government is trying to work out is, how do they handle this? How deeply involved do they get in it? How much do they leave this to the Irish authorities, and how much of a responsibility do they have to him? But the interesting thing on this allegation from Peter Robinson is, even allowing for the fact that obviously if there was a British government plot to kill him, we're not going to have a file on that that's going to be released to somebody like me. So let's accept that for now. What we do see in these files is that civil servants at a mid-ranking and a very senior level in the Northern Ireland office, in the Foreign Office, elsewhere in government, in the RUC, are working, it seems to me, pretty assiduously to try to protect him. They're getting in touch with the Irish government. The Foreign Secretary sends a personal memo to the Dublin Embassy saying, I want you to raise this with the Irish government to ensure that he is protected. And there is no hint here whatsoever that anything of what he alleged he had been told actually happened. And ultimately, there was a court appearance in Dundalk where there was a riot.
The court was packed for the brief hearing, with Peter Robinson flanked by his wife Iris and by Ian Paisley. The prosecuting solicitor read out the charges: unlawful assembly, two assaults causing actual bodily harm, and malicious damage to a Garda car. Then both he and Dr. Paisley sped off north. On the way in, their car had been kicked. On the way out, it was jeered. Their supporters were escorted back to their cars by Gardaí in riot gear. Stones were thrown, and many of the loyalists, huddled together and silent, held clothes over their heads to protect themselves, but not well enough for what was to come.
Peter Robinson said although he wanted to make another appearance in court, he would have to carefully consider his own personal safety before he made a final decision.
But after that, there was no sense whatsoever from these files of him coming to the government and saying that he had any concerns about his personal security. And actually, what Ian Paisley, what some of the other people from the DUP say, is that the Irish Guards had been incredibly helpful to them. They had protected them. And ultimately, there's this one anecdote where an Irish police officer does something which helped Peter Robinson in a way that perhaps he didn't even realise at the time. But in this file, you see something that was being fed back to the British government, sat in this file for many decades, and now has been released.
Now, one of the other headlines was that Peter Robinson privately briefed the NIO and worked to manoeuvre Ian Paisley, Dr. Paisley, the Reverend Ian Paisley, into talks, because people mightn't remember at the time, I mean, the DUP were strongly opposed to the peace process, as we call it now, for a long, long time before they eventually went all in.
If we go back to the mid-1980s, the Anglo-Irish Agreement happens in 1985. For the first time, it gives the Irish Republic a role, a consultative role in the internal affairs of Northern Ireland. And this infuriates unionism. It's a massive constitutional development. They've been cut out of the loop in this. It comes as a complete surprise to many of them. And there are these enormous demonstrations. Ian Paisley famously addresses huge crowds, hundreds of thousands of people in Belfast city centre. He gives his no, 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 no speech, which he's probably best remembered for. But at the same time, unionism basically breaks off contact with the government. It boycotts government. It won't talk to ministers. And there's this very long period of unionism refusing to accept, basically, that they won't get rid of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. It's going to be there. Ultimately, in the Good Friday Agreement, they sort of got the fig leaf, if you like, of saying they'd got rid of it. But essentially what they did was replicate many of its terms and got rid of some of it because they accepted power sharing, which had really always been on the table from the 1980s and indeed prior to that. So when you get to this period of the early 1990s where this particular file relates to, Peter Robinson is talking to the NIO. So that in itself is interesting. He's working with government. Government is very much seen by many of these hardline unionists at this point as the enemy. He's working with them. He's briefing them. And what he's saying to them and what some other people in the DUP are saying to the NIO is that Ian Paisley is the problem. Basically, all of them, almost at a senior level in the DUP, want to get back into talks with the government. And Paisley is holding hard against this. And Paisley is such a big figure, they can't just go against him. So he's trying to work with the government and trying to manoeuvre his party leader into a place where the government can do things that will help to get him in. And ultimately, that's where things go. But what you see here is behind the scenes, Peter Robinson is crucial to that process.
I suppose for many people who look at the DUP today, see a variety of big names, a variety of different, slightly different approaches and big personalities. But at the time, the DUP was Ian Paisley. Now, he had a lieutenant in Peter Robinson and everyone else was a mere private.
Yeah, I mean, look, probably the closest example that I can think of in modern politics, and he's not technically a party leader right now, although quite possibly within a few weeks he will be again, is Nigel Farage, somebody who is bigger than the political party they lead. Look at Nigel Farage. He's led any number of parties with different names. This is at least his third, I think, that he's on now with Reform UK. And he is just this enormous personality. Boris Johnson has always been with the Conservative Party, but he's the sort of figure who could go to another party. Donald Trump is like that. If he left the Republican Party in America, he'd still be this enormous figure. Paisley was this person. I mean, he just dominated that section of unionist politics. But Peter Robinson was the person who was absolutely central behind the scenes. He was the person that was central to, I suppose, turning Paisleyism into something that was more than simply Paisleyism, turning it into the DUP, turning it into something that was more effective, that was less impulsive, that was more organised, more strategic. And so he needs Paisley, and ultimately he did need Paisley, and the party needed Paisley, and the government needed Paisley to do that final deal in 2007 to go into power sharing with Sinn Féin. But Paisley is the crucial person that they can't move without.
The current Deputy First Minister, Emma Little Pengelly, is of course from the DUP. Now, and of course, want to cast aspersions because you can't help who your parents are. But according to the files, Emma Little Pengelly's father was a leading UDA man who was key to the Missiles for Arms plot. I mean, what was that plot and who are we talking about?
So this is a man called Noel Little from Market Hill. He lives in Belfast now. And he is someone who is well known to people who are students of Northern Irish history over the period of the 1980s. But there'll be a lot of people who have never heard his name, know nothing about him. And in 1989, he was arrested by French police in Paris with two other men. And they were in the Paris Hilton Hotel with an American arms dealer called Douglas Bernhardt and with a South African diplomat who was an intelligence officer working for a major South African arms manufacturer called Arms Corps. And that man's name was Daniel Storm. So these people were sitting in a hotel and they were observed by French police who had been spying on them basically for some time, having been tipped off by MI5 in Britain, that they were trying to sell, allegedly, missile technology from Short's Missile Systems in Belfast. That's now known as Thales Air Defence, still based in East Belfast. And they were trying to sell, allegedly, the technology and some of their missiles that were used by the British Army and by other armed forces around the world to the South African apartheid regime. Now, that was significant for multiple reasons.
Even if it wasn't, you know, selling the military technology of your own country to another country. I mean, that's espionage. That's a big deal.
It's an extraordinary thing to do. I mean, I think lots of people who have looked at this have assumed that this was almost a farcical plot, if you like. And there are elements of it that are completely farcical. But I think sometimes that obscures that this was potentially deadly. This was something that if it had come off, if the intent that allegedly was there had been satisfied, then this would potentially have led to people being killed, not just in Northern Ireland, and it would have led to people potentially being killed in Northern Ireland, but at the other end of the world, in the other hemisphere. So there is an arms embargo on South Africa because of the system of apartheid in this period. And what South Africa is trying to do here is find unorthodox ways of essentially stealing other nations' military secrets. So if they can't import weapons from America, from Britain, from other major world economies, they want to be able to copy them and replicate them themselves, not just domestically where they're fighting a war at this point and they need better weapons, but to sell them to other nations. So this is very, very significant for South Africa.
According to these files, Noah Little was a leading UDA man. Now, he's also been connected to Ulster Resistance. Now, could you just explain in very briefly what Ulster Resistance was and its link to this story?
Ulster Resistance was formed by the DUP in the Ulster Hall in 1986. It was a reaction, if you like, to the Anglo-Irish Agreement. And it was part of a wider move by a significant section of unionism to become much more hardline, to become much more militaristic, to become much more cut off, if you like, from the idea of supporting the British Armed Forces and the RUC and the other organs of the British state, and moving towards this idea of a doomsday scenario, that if Northern Ireland was going to cease to become British, if there was going to be civil war, if Britain was going to suddenly withdraw, that they were going to have weapons, that they were going to have a cadre of men who were trained and disciplined, almost going back to the idea of the old UVF, if you like, in the period prior to the First World War. And this was something which Ian Paisley was central to setting up. He spoke at the rally in the Ulster Hall, and Peter Robinson was there, other senior DUP figures were there. The press were kept out of that, but there is a recording of that which records some of what was said at that meeting. And in it, Ian Paisley is heard to say that he will give whatever political cover is needed to this new organisation. Now, ultimately, in late 1987 and early 1988, this organisation joined together, Ulster Resistance joined together with the UDA and the UVF. They imported a massive shipment of arms to Northern Ireland. There was a link to South Africa in that. I think they ultimately came via Lebanon, but there was a link to South Africa and possibly to Israel. Those arms got into Northern Ireland. Some of them were seized by the authorities immediately. They had knowledge of that from informers. Some of those arms have never been recovered. There were three sections of that shipment. One went to the UDA, one went to the UVF, and one went to Ulster Resistance. The one that went to Ulster Resistance is the one that has never been decommissioned and was used in the murder of many, many innocent Catholics in Northern Ireland.
Ulster Resistance was a paramilitary group founded by the DUP.
But it's very important to get across this. Once that arms shipment emerged, the DUP came out and essentially immediately washed its hands of this outfit. So Paisley had stood up and said, we will give you whatever political cover you want, or rather you need, I should say. And once this happens, the DUP say, well, we didn't think they were going to do that. We never thought they would do anything illegal. I think it does raise the question of if the DUP didn't think they needed guns or needed to do anything that was of a paramilitary nature, if you like, what did they think this group was going to do? You know, was it some sort of dad's army without guns? But anyway, at that point, there's this very public disassociation, breaking of ties as far as the public statements from the DUP go. And so they say from that point on, they had nothing to do with it. They say they're not responsible for the guns. They're not responsible for what the guns did. They're not responsible for now decommissioning the guns. And that's basically where it sits. And I think, again, going back to these three loyalists being lifted in Paris, just as lots of people look at that and think it's a bit farcical, there are people who I think their sense of Ulster Resistance is that it was a bit of a joke. I mean, it was ludicrous. Paisley set this thing up. It fizzled out. They pranced around in uniforms. They had maroon berets on. They walked up and down hillsides late at night. And ultimately, they did nothing. And it, you know, it was a farcical thing. It was something that basically Paisley was lampooned for within sections of wider loyalism. I think what you get from these files and what you get from some other documentation is a sense that this group was far more significant to the Troubles than people maybe realise. They might not have been the people using these guns, but they got the guns in here. And that led to things like the Loughan Island massacre. It led to some of the worst atrocities of the early 1990s. And after these guns get into Northern Ireland, the loyalist killing rate goes through the roof. They actually overtake the IRA. It becomes a really horrific period in Northern Ireland. It's the period where John Hume breaks down in tears after the Grey Steel massacre, I think it was, where he's at the funeral of one of the victims. It was just this sense of hopelessness that we've gone over the edge of the abyss. And these are the weapons, very sophisticated weapons, weapons that are far deadlier, far fewer people are surviving once they're shot with these weapons. These are the weapons that let that happen. And if we look at what happened in Paris, Paris is not about those weapons. And what Noel Little says is that he denies ever having been involved in that earlier shipment of arms. But what Paris is about, allegedly, according to these files from MI5's understanding of this, is that there was an attempt to trade missile technology for either guns directly from South Africa or for money from South Africa, £1 million or more, which would be used to buy guns. That's what was alleged at the time. That goes straight to the Secretary of State. And in the briefing to the Secretary of State, as soon as Noel Little is arrested, one of the most senior MI5 officers in Belfast, Stephen Rickard, who was killed a few years later on the Chinook crash in 1994, he tells the Secretary of State that Noel Little is a leading UDA man. Now, it's been known that he was Ulster Resistance. There's been no secret about that. I don't think it's ever been alleged before that he was a UDA man.
In terms of these allegations, have they ever been put to Noel Little by journalists, and has he been convicted in a court of law of any of these allegations which MI5 make against him?
Yes, so Noel Little was convicted in 1991, along with two other men who were with him at the time, Samuel Quinn and James King. And all three of them, along with Doug Bernhardt, who was the American arms dealer, were convicted of their role in this plot.
The three men were arrested 2.5 years ago by French anti-terrorist police in a Paris hotel. The prosecution said they were handing over parts of a dummy blowpipe missile to a member of the South African embassy. The men, who were described as members of Ulster Resistance, are Noel Little from Market Hill, James King from Killaloe, and Samuel Quinn from Newtownards in County Down. The three judges handed down their verdicts in a 2-minute hearing, which heard allegations of a major cash deal with Pretoria. During the trial, the court heard that Douglas Bernhardt had put the loyalists in contact with a Lebanese arms dealer, who arranged a delivery of £120,000 worth of arms and rocket launchers from Beirut.
And the level of concern in the Ministry of Defence that this is part of a wider sense they have that there are just multiple leaks out of Short's missile systems. Documents from the MOD are stolen from the car of somebody who works there in Bangor. There are parts going missing, some from a TA centre. Others are found, a Javelin missile, blowpipe missile. And initially what they had been told by Short's was that essentially, don't be too worried about this. These are dummy weapons, or they're weapons that are pretty inert. They can't really do very much. So we're fairly relaxed about this. What you see from these files is that they actually, a few weeks later, are told by Short's, there's more to this than we initially thought. There is a prototype weapon in development, which deals with a problem with the Javelin missile that's in use at that point by the British Army. And it's very susceptible to jamming. And this might give away to the South Africans or anybody else who gets this, that we have a problem with this current missile. But if we go back to what Noel Little said, I contacted him in relation to what's in this file. And what he said to me was, any allegation of criminal behaviour is strongly denied. I have never been a member of an illegal organisation. A significant amount of nonsense has been spoken over the years in relation to this matter. I will not be commenting further on this.
Sam, we understand that Noel Little has campaigned for Emma Little Pengelly in a political sense.
He has.
So I think it is fair to ask her, in terms of the politics about this. You have spoken to her about this.
So there are two elements of this that I think are questions that are fair to ask Emma Little Pengelly. It's obviously not fair in any way to infer that somebody's parents' actions are in any way something that reflect on them as an individual. I'm no more accountable for my parents' actions than Emma Little Pengelly is for hers. But what is relevant here, and what I did ask her about, are two particular elements of this. The DUP has very publicly condemned Sinn Féin for having former IRA members out campaigning for Sinn Féin at election time. Well, Noel Little has been pictured more than once campaigning with his daughter. And so therefore, there is a very obvious question there for her as to whether that is a consistent position for her. And then secondly, and more significantly, I think here, is the fact that these weapons have never been decommissioned. We know that Ulster Resistance was a pretty shadowy outfit. Lots of the people involved with it are not necessarily very well known. Noel Little is one of the few people that was convicted, not in this country, but he was convicted somewhere in relation to a plot that involved Ulster Resistance. Does he know anything about those guns? Does he know where they are or where they were or who might know? And this is someone with whom she, as a political leader, has unique influence. She's not accountable for what he did. She's not responsible for making him do anything. But if this was, for instance, her best friend or somebody that she lived with or anything of that nature, this would be an obvious question. So I put those two questions to her. She came back with a written statement that said, quote, "A child should not be held accountable for the alleged actions of their father. I abhor violence wherever it came from. There was always a political alternative to using violence. That's why I have dedicated much of my life to helping victims access justice and ensure Northern Ireland is a reconciled place, never again allowed to fall into the grip of terrorism. Any person with knowledge of unlawful activity should come forward and share that knowledge with the PSNI."
There, Sam McBride, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This episode of The Bell Tale was produced by Olivia Peden. The sound design was by Graham Davidson.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.